Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, April 18, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be giving you an update on litigation concerning the HHS contraceptive mandate. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome two experts to our telephone conference call, and as in calls past, their complete bios have been provided to you in the notice of this call and are available on our website, so I'm going to be very brief in my introductions. We'll hear opening remarks first from Mr. Bill Saunders, William Saunders, who is Senior Vice President for Legal Affairs and Senior Counsel at Americans United for Life. He'll speak for about 10 minutes. After that, we'll hear from Professor Mark Rienzi. He's Senior Counsel at the Beckett Fund and also Associate Professor at the Catholic University of America. He'll be giving us about 15 minutes of remarks. After we hear from both of them, we might have a little bit of back and forth, but then we will ultimately get to questions from the audience at that point in time. And with that, Mr. Saunders, please go right ahead with your remarks.
Thank you, Dean. listeners on this call are probably aware that the Department of Health and Human Services announced on February the 1st the issuance of a new proposed rule regarding its preventive services mandate. The public comment period on the proposed rule ended on April the 8th. Thus, HHS should be considering the comments that are submitted during that period and issue a final rule at some point in the next few months. Professor Rienzi and I will offer some comments subsequently as to whether the new proposed regulations of February the 1st, if promulgated as in that form, would resolve the controversy, but I believe it would be helpful first to review the history of the issue briefly. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, enacted in March of 2010, mandated that all insurance plans except those that were grandfathered on the date of the law's enactment or exempted, provide full coverage for, quote, preventive services, end quote, for women. However, Congress did not spell out in the statute the items and services that are included in this mandate. Rather, it delegated that determination to the Health Resources Services Administration, or HRSA, an agency under the Department of Health and Human Services. On July 19, 2010, HHS issued an interim final rule for group health plans and health insurance providers relating to coverage of preventive services under the Affordable Care Act. The regulation specified that HHS was developing guidelines on, quote, evidence-informed preventive care and screening, end quote, for women that would be issued no later than the following August. The Institute of Medicine was subsequently tasked with providing a recommendation on what these guidelines should include. In July of 2011, the Institute of Medicine made its recommendations. The recommendations included coverage of sterilizations and all, quote, Food and Drug Administration approved contraceptives, end quote. That recommendation, however, includes drugs and devices with known life-ending mechanisms of action. For instance, Uliprystal or Ella is covered under the IOM recommendations as preventive services that would be required in the plan. And Uliprystal or Ella has the same mechanism as RU46. It's an abortion drug that can interrupt an established pregnancy. Also, devices and drugs that can prevent the implantation of an embryo are included, such as intrauterine devices and the morning after or pill or plan B. Subsequently, HRSA adopted the recommendations from the Institute of Medicine, and HHS issued an amended regulation including the recommendations from IOM through HRSA and providing an exemption for religious employers. I won't go into the details, but the exemption for religious employers was very narrow, essentially only applying to churches, synagogues, mosques, etc., and religious orders. Now, many thousands of Americans who had religious and other objections to the provision of contraceptives, abortifacients, and sterilizations as preventive services tried to convince the Obama administration in the intervening months to amend the regulation before it was officially promulgated. However, on January 20th of 2012, HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius announced that the regulation, as it had originally been announced in August, would not be changed. She said that religious organizations, however, would be given an additional year to comply with the regulation. Her announcement hardly silenced the critics, as one of them said, quote, "In effect, the president is saying that we have a year to figure out how to violate our consciences," end quote. And that position was widely held. So opposition to the regulation and what Secretary Sebelius had said in January continued to grow. So consequently, on February the 10th, 2012, President Obama and Secretary Sebelius announced at a press conference that religious institutions and organizations that were not exempt under, and remember I said that was very narrow, so religious organizations and institutions that were not exempt, such as hospitals and universities, would be required to provide the would not be required to provide the services they objected to. Instead, the insurance companies themselves would be required to offer the services for free. Nonetheless, although the president and Secretary Sebelius said this at the press conference, their promise on this point was not incorporated in the regulation, and the regulation was officially promulgated on the same day as the press conference, unchanged from the August version. So, the criticism did not abate, and it, in fact, increased. The points made were that religious institutions were still being coerced into providing insurance policies covering objectionable services contrary to their religious beliefs, and other Americans, such as those secular nonprofits, for-profit companies, including insurance companies, self-insured organizations, and individuals, were still being required to provide funding of such services. So many lawsuits were filed by wide variety of plaintiffs challenging the preventive services mandate. Some of these plaintiffs were Catholics, some of them were Protestants, some of them were neither. Some of them objected to providing the abortifacients, some of them objected to providing the contraceptives, sterilizations, and abortifacients. All of the lawsuits have two grounds, essentially, the First Amendment and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, a standard of strict scrutiny, in order for the government to justify substantially burdening the free exercise of religion, it must both have a compelling, this must be pursuant to a compelling state interest, and it must show that it's using the least burdensome means. Now, in practice, these lawsuits have fallen into two categories. Some of the cases have been dismissed by the courts, particularly involving religious educational institutions. And I quote the reason as an example, but as I think an instructive example for most of the cases where there's been a dismissal, from one of the court opinions. Quote, "Because the government has indicated its intention to amend the regulations to better take into account religious objections, and because plaintiff is protected in the interim by safe harbor provision, the court finds that the injury is too speculative to confer standing and the case is not ripe for decision. Dismissal without prejudice is thus appropriate, end quote. In other words, the court was relying on the interim safe harbor I mentioned and the president's promise to change the regulations for religious organizations as a ground for concluding that the matter was not ripe for resolution by the courts. Now, those two points, however, do not apply to private employers. So the second category that has emerged in the cases has to do with for-profit employers challenging the mandate. And they stand to incur substantial penalties for not covering these services. And the cases have gone forward where there have been a number of rulings on preliminary injunctions, and some issues have surfaced. So to discuss that, I will turn the call over to Mark Renzi.
Thank you very much, Bill. What I want to do for the next 15 minutes is give the overview of the two sets of cases, the nonprofit cases and the for-profit cases, and give everybody an update on where that all stands and what you can expect going forward. There are now over 50 lawsuits challenging the HHS mandate, more than 150 different plaintiffs. Big picture, you can lump those cases into two categories, the nonprofit cases and the for-profit cases. The nonprofits are your Notre Dame's, your Wheaton College's, your Archdiocese of Washington cases. And generally speaking, with at least one notable exception, but generally speaking, the courts have put the nonprofit cases on hold. And they put the nonprofit cases on hold because after those cases were filed, the government came into court and said, you know what, we're going to think about it a little more, and we're going to come up with some sort of new accommodation to try to make it better for the religious nonprofits. And to date, most of the courts to consider it have said, okay, if the government's going to come up with a new accommodation and if the government promises not to enforce the mandate against these nonprofits in the interim, we're not going to let those nonprofit cases go forward. We're going to see what the government comes up with. That has not been uniform. So at least one of the cases is moving forward and into discovery against the government. But by and large, the courts have said that the nonprofits should wait, see what the accommodation is that comes out of the rulemaking process. And then I believe every judge to dismiss one of the cases has also said, and if you don't like what you get in the accommodation, you're perfectly free to come back and restart your claim. As to the proposed accommodation, what the government proposes to do is to establish three tiers of religious freedom. So the top tier, the one that gets real and true protection, is churches and religious orders. So Saint So-and-So's church and the Little Sisters of such-and-such as a religious order, they can be completely exempt so long as they file their federal taxes as churches or religious orders. That's a very narrow slice of the world. So to give just one example, the Little Sisters of the Poor, they operate nursing homes around the country for very poor, very sick people who have no place to go. They essentially comfort the people until they die for free. That's the mission of the Little Sisters of the Poor. The Little Sisters themselves, as an order, don't have to provide coverage for these drugs. In other words, Sister Mary Jane doesn't have to have in her policy that she gets access to these drugs. But when the Little Sisters operate their nursing homes to take care of these old poor people as they die, the government said, well, you've got two choices. You can either stop doing that or you can start providing the drugs. When I say start providing the drugs, I mean you can go along with our accommodation. You're not completely exempt. So the exempt category, very narrow. The second tier is the non-exempt religious nonprofits, which is where those nursing homes from the Little Sisters of the Poor would fall and where the Notre Dames and Wheatons of the world fall. In that middle tier, the government has said the following, at least this is their proposal. If you are a nonprofit and you are a religious nonprofit with a religious objection to providing some of this stuff, we will let you not write the words Plan B, Ella, IUDs, abortifacients, into your insurance policies. You don't have to write it there, and you won't have to pay for it. But the instant you provide the policy, as a matter of law, the insurance company that you selected will have to give a separate separate rider policy to the employee who you connected with that insurer that covers all the drugs. The government's argument is that, well, at that point, they've done enough to address the religious objection. Many of the religious objectors have been saying in comments to the federal government that that's not enough, that they are still involved, that the government is forcing them to take a step, issuing health insurance, that as a matter of law includes free access to these drugs, not only for their employees, but also free access to the drugs, for example, for their employees' minor children. And therefore, many of the nonprofits still have those religious objections to the proposed accommodation. Now, the proposed accommodation is not yet a final rule. It is a proposed rule. That's what was proposed in early February. The Department of HHS received something like 350,000 comments, which at least according to one website I saw was some sort of record for comments in a federal government rulemaking. And theoretically, HHS is now going to sit down and think about those 350,000 comments as it makes up its mind. The reality is that that's exceedingly unlikely. On Monday, April 8th, Secretary Sebelius was speaking at Harvard, and so that's actually the day the comments were due. The comment period hadn't quite closed yet. But she said at Harvard that as of August 1st, every employee who doesn't work directly for a church or diocese will be included in the contraceptive benefit package, and that, quote, Catholic hospitals, Catholic universities, and other religious entities will be providing that coverage to their employees starting August 1st. So that's a pretty good indication that Secretary Sebelius had already made up her mind even before the comments were in. In any case, those nonprofit cases, I suspect, will begin restarting once HHS actually issues a final rule. Again, one of them is proceeding into discovery. Most of the action to date, though, has been on the for-profit cases. These are the Hobby Lobbies of the world, the businesses that say, the business's owner says, look, I cannot provide insurance coverage for these drugs and devices that may cause abortions. Therefore, when the government tries to force me to do it, it's violating my rights. As Bill pointed out, the principal claims in these cases, there are more, but the principal claims are under the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. The government said in its rulemaking that while it's willing to protect religious freedom for churches and religious orders, and it's willing to, at some level, accommodate, although with what ultimately will likely be an unsatisfactory accommodation, it's willing to, at some level, accommodate religious nonprofits, the government has said that no such accommodation will be permissible for a for-profit employer. In other words, once you go out and earn money, you have no religious liberty rights under this regime. And because of that, the for-profit cases have been the ones that have really surged to the forefront of the litigation. They're the places where we're getting substantive rulings in many, many courts across the country, which are now moving to the courts of appeal. So those cases, again, are primarily litigated under RFRA and the First Amendment. RFRA, after the Smith case in 1990, reestablished the compelling interest test as the standard test for when the federal government burdens religious freedom. There was a case that said that RFRA cannot extend that rule to state actions, but as when the federal government burdens religion, RFRA is clearly the law. RFRA, generally speaking, embodies a policy decision that in a pluralistic and diverse country, generally speaking, the government shouldn't force people to violate their religion unless there's a really good reason for it. But that the presumption ought to be that this is a free country, it's a diverse country, people have different views, and we're generally not in the business of forcing people to give up or violate those views unless there's a really good reason. And the legal formulation of that test is the compelling interest test. The government, if it puts a substantial burden on somebody's religion, it must demonstrate that putting that burden on that person satisfies a compelling government interest and is the least restrictive means to serve that interest. It's an enormously difficult test for the government to pass. The Supreme Court has called it the most demanding test known to constitutional law, generally speaking, when that's the test the government's supposed to lose. And in fact, in the for-profit mandate cases, what's been happening to date is the government has been losing. There are a few more than two dozen such cases, 23 of which have resulted in some sort of substantive ruling at the preliminary injunction or temporary restraining order stage. Right now, the business plaintiffs are winning 17-6. So out of 23 decisions, 17 of them say actually the for-profit business and its owner do get some protection for their religious exercise, and they are likely to prevail in showing that the government can't impose this kind of mandate. And a handful of reasons for those rulings. One, although some courts have said there is no substantial burden, the argument against a substantial burden is really pretty weak. The courts in almost all of the circuits under RFRA, and before that the Supreme Court under the Free Exercise Clause, have long said that a substantial burden exists where the government has put substantial pressure on a believer to act contrary to what their religion requires. So the substantial burden test, when applied properly, asks the question, is there government coercion to violate the believer's beliefs here? And in the mandate cases, there's just no question that there is. If you accept the sincerity of the religious beliefs of the people bringing the claims, which the government has not challenged in any of these cases and the courts have not challenged, if you accept that they sincerely do believe they cannot do this, it's pretty easy to show a substantial burden because they are going to be fined hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. In Hobby Lobby's case, the fines could exceed $1 million each day because they won't provide just a couple of drugs. So there's clearly substantial government pressure on them to violate their beliefs, which means that if the analysis is done properly, the government is forced to show they've got a compelling government interest and that this is the least restrictive means of advancing that interest. And the government has very little chance of ever being able to pass that test for a number of reasons. One of them is the grandfathering provision in the Affordable Care Act. So although the government refuses to give exceptions to what is probably a relatively small number nationwide of religious objectors, they have exempted plans covering, I believe, at least 100 million people from the contraceptive mandate because those plans are grandfathered. So President Obama made a promise during the push to pass the law saying if you like your health care, you can keep it. That resulted in a provision in the statute called the grandfathering provision that said if your policy's been in effect since a certain date and it hasn't made certain changes, you can keep your policy as is. Congress did say even with grandfathering, there are some things those policies are going to have to do, like cover cover children up to age 26, children on parents' policies. So there are some things Congress thought were important enough to even make the grandfathered plans do. But they didn't do that for preventative care and the contraceptive mandate. And so the government would have to be able to convince a court that this is a compellingly important government interest to make sure each of these religious objectors covers the drug, and yet it's willing to allow that interest to not be enforced in plans covering 100 million other people, essentially to keep the president's political promise. It's a very, very difficult argument to make. Last point I'll make briefly, the government's argument that for-profit businesses and the people who run them don't have religious liberty is obviously wrong for a few different reasons. One, all that's necessary for a religious freedom claim under both RFRA and the Free Exercise Clause is to engage in a religious exercise, which the court has defined to be engaging in religiously motivated conduct. To give you a really simple example, Hobby Lobby each Easter and each Christmas takes out ads in the newspapers talking about the religious meaning of the holidays. And this is Hobby Lobby, Inc., the corporation, the for-profit corporation, takes out these ads. And the ads tell people about the religious reasons behind the holidays. And the ads invite people to get to know Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior by calling the following number. That is clearly and indisputably an exercise of religion by a for-profit business. If taking out advertisements and encouraging people to know Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior is not an exercise of religion, then nothing is. The fact of the matter is we accept for-profit businesses acting on ethical, moral, and philosophical grounds all the time in all sorts of other contexts. If you've ever tried to buy meat at Whole Foods, you know, they have a color-coded system based on how well the pig or the chicken or the cow was treated. There are some types of animals they will not put on their shelves because they believe, as a moral matter, that animals shouldn't be treated in certain ways, and it's their right to do so. Chipotle recently made a stir in Utah because they said they could no longer partner with the Boy Scouts because the Boy Scouts do not have gay scout leaders. Nobody questions the fact that Chipotle, a for-profit business, is able to make what it views as a moral and ethical decision during its for-profit business that I don't want to be part of X, and they don't want to be associated with the Boy Scouts, and in America, that's their right. The notion that for-profit businesses can make all sorts of moral and philosophical decisions about the environment or same-sex marriage or diversity or treating animals properly, but they are not permitted to make them about religion, is baseless and is actually itself an impermissible discrimination against religious motivations. And last thing I'll say is if you look at the First Amendment in the speech context, both in Citizens United and in earlier cases too, the court has said the distinction between for-profits and nonprofits doesn't matter. In the commercial speech context, it doesn't matter. Many of our leading Establishment Clause cases are brought by for-profit businesses, and it doesn't matter. The government has to sell the argument that the one and apparently only one place in the Constitution where earning profits requires you to forfeit your rights is in the area of religious exercise. I don't think they'll actually be able to sell that. Let me stop there.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Before we open the floor to questions, let me see if Bill Saunders has anything he wants to add at this point in response to what Mark Rienzi said. Bill, do you have anything further at this point?
No, I don't think so. I would just say this. The bottom line on the regulations that were issued, the proposed regulation of February 1st is that if adopted as issued February the 1st, it's not going to resolve the matter. So this litigation is going forward.
All right, very good. In a moment, we should all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So stand by for that announcement. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And before we go to our callers, let me make our typical programming announcement. For tomorrow, we have a Teleform conference call scheduled at 12 noon at this same number, 12 noon Eastern time, I should say, when we'll be discussing copyright enforcement. Today, of course, we're discussing the HHS contraceptive mandate and the many cases that are ongoing surrounding that mandate. If you have a question for either of our experts, we're speaking with Professor Mark Rienzi and Bill Saunders, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. It looks like at this point we have one question, so let's go to our first caller.
First of all, thanks very much for this update. It's enormously informative. Wanted to ask you, there are some employers out there who are looking seriously at changing their plan years to try to get more time to avoid the possible penalties from not providing this coverage. And there are provisions of the Affordable Care Act that address the inability to do that for certain provisions, such as the $2,500 FSA provision. There was a release from the IRS at the end of December that said you can't change your plan year to avoid the employer mandates unless you've already got a fiscal year plan. But there doesn't seem to be any explicit prohibition, at least, against moving your plan year to delay compliance with this contraceptive mandate. And I was just wondering if either of you wanted to comment on that as a possible strategy. And again, thanks very much for this session.
This is Mark Rienzi. So I'm not anything close to an insurance lawyer, and I wouldn't purport to give anybody advice as to what is permissible in terms of insurance under ERISA or anything like that. But I will say that my understanding is that the mandate takes effect in your first plan year after, if you're a for-profit, after August 1st, 2012, and if you're a nonprofit, after August 1st, 2013. I am aware that at least some businesses and nonprofits have looked at that very issue and have said, wait a second, if I can get on a July to July plan year, I can at least buy myself a little bit more time before the mandate kicks in. So basically, if it works from an insurance perspective, I think it's a very smart move from a religious liberty perspective.
Bill Saunders, did you want to weigh in on this point?
No, I don't have anything to add to that.
Okay. Our phone lines are open.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you. Our phone lines are open. If you have a question, if you want to join the queue, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And let me continue with our programming announcement, discussing our calls next week. First, people should feel free to check in at the Federalist Society website on the Teleforum calendar, which is subject to change. We're hoping to provide a Teleforum call on Monday on the Kiobel decision that came out yesterday concerning the extraterritorial application of the Alien Tort Statute Supreme Court case decided yesterday. That call will likely take place on Monday, although it's not officially scheduled. Then on Tuesday, we'll hold a Teleforum call on corporate public disclosure of political activity. Wednesday, our topic will be look at the world after Hugo Chavez. Thursday, we'll have a Teleforum call on the perceived war on women. And then Friday, we will have a Teleforum call on Missouri versus McNeely, another Supreme Court case decided yesterday that you might have read about, and that concerns warrants and extracting blood from drivers to test for blood alcohol levels without warrants. We have one question on our board at this point. Again, if you want to join the queue, you need to push the star and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Thank you guys for a great presentation. I just had a quick question. I was wondering whether the government in structuring the new rules they have and, you know, having the insurance issuer provide the contraceptive coverage instead of, you know, the nonprofit religious college, for example, you know, how that might affect the standing analysis going forward. In reading a lot of the complaints, that's one of their big, tools that they try to use to defeat these claims. And I wonder if that might be sort of in their mind about trying to undermine standing of these colleges going forward by trying to say that, hey, you guys aren't providing it. It's not that you don't have standing to challenge this. It might be an issuer might have standing, but you may not. Just wanted to get your comments on that and see your thoughts were on that.
So this is Mark Rienzi. I don't think they'll get very far with a standing argument for the following reason. The Notre Dames of the world are still being forced by the government to provide insurance. So in the Lujan case, the court said essentially, well, if the law applies to you, you do have standing to challenge it. And so what I suspect, and I don't, to be clear, I don't represent Notre Dame, but what I suspect a Notre Dame complaint would look like post-rule, if the rule comes out, is they would say, I cannot comply with the mandate you've put on my shoulders, which is you must provide insurance, because of this ride-along thing that you say happens with it. So there is no doubt that Notre Dame is being forced by the government to do something. What they're being forced to do is to provide health insurance. And they are objecting to doing that based on what the government says is the automatic consequence of them doing that, which is something they can't do. So I don't think the government will be able to successfully say, okay, now Notre Dame has no claim to be in court at all. The bottom line is if Notre Dame has been stripped of the ability to make the decision that says, well, I can't give that policy because that includes things that kill people, right? Pre-mandate, Notre Dame had that ability. Post-mandate, they don't. And so the bottom line is the requirement operates directly on them. I agree. I do think the government is trying to sort of put Notre Dame further away from the stuff Notre Dame doesn't like. But ultimately, I think sort of when it's far enough away is not so much a standing question. It's a religious question for the religious believer. The standing is going to be there because Notre Dame is still required by law to provide the policy. And that's something that Notre Dame is likely to be saying we cannot do because of the things that go with it.
I understand that our usual email reminder about the beginning of this call, the commencement of this call, was delayed, and that some people have only fairly recently joined us. So we are speaking with Professor Mark Rienzi and Bill Saunders about the HHS contraceptive mandate litigation. We've already concluded our opening remarks, and we're now in the question and answer portion of the call. If you'd like to join the queue, if you have a question, our lines are completely open at this point. You need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. The star button
and then the pound button on your telephone. And Bill, I don't know if you have a question for Mark Rienzi while we wait to see if there are more questions from our audience.
Yeah. Yes, Dean, I can just raise a couple of points. One of them is, Mark, you mentioned in your very excellent remarks at the beginning of the call, the fact that most of the for-profit litigation where there's been a decision on preliminary injunctions have resulted in a win for the plaintiffs, some have not, and that. But I wonder if you could say a couple more words about the grounds on which the decisions have gone against the plaintiffs. For instance, some courts have said there's not a substantial injury, it's only a slight injury, and it's only slight, so you don't even get to the question of compelling state interest and least restrictive means, because what is going on is an objection that somebody in the future will use the insurance, an employee in the future will use the insurance to get contraceptives or sterilizations, and that this is only a slight burden on the employer or the institution.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. That's an excellent question, and if I had had more time to speak before, I probably would have gotten that in. So you're exactly right. The grounds on which the outlier courts, the handful that have ruled for the government here, have ruled for the government is that they say, one, they say, look, the individual who owns the company has no rights here. We're making the company do it, not you. That doesn't really fly, of course, because the company is paper and brick and mortar. The company doesn't act unless the people who control the company make it act. So the government is forcing the people who run the company to do things. The second argument they make, and the one that a handful of courts have accepted, is the one Bill laid out, which is they say, well, maybe it's a burden, but it's not a substantial burden because, and their because is they say, you're far enough removed from the thing you object to, the abortion-inducing drugs or devices and so forth, that it's not a big burden on you. You're not being forced to hand out the drugs. You're not being forced to take the drugs. You just have to give out an insurance policy, and somebody else is going to make later independent decisions about it, and therefore your religious belief that you can't give out the policy has not been substantially burdened. Here's what's fundamentally and deeply wrong with that approach. It takes the substantial burden inquiry and turns it from a focus on the government's coercion, which is where it's supposed to be, under Supreme Court law and binding circuit precedent and all the circuits where judges have gotten this wrong. The focus of the substantial burden inquiry is on, is there government coercion? And those courts have twisted the inquiry to say that the real question should be, let me explore the underlying religious belief behind the religious exercise. In these cases, the burden inquiry should be really straightforward and simple. The religious exercise is, I can't give out this insurance policy. The reasons you can't give out that insurance policy, so long as they are sincere religious reasons, are irrelevant to the substantial burden inquiry. In other words, if the court's doing it properly, the court should not distinguish between someone who, A, says, I have an objection to all insurance because my religious teachings tell me insurance is evil, or B, I have an objection to this insurance policy because it may let somebody later choose to have an abortion. Federal law, the Free Exercise Clause, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, don't have anything that indicates that courts are supposed to be distinguishing based on the type of underlying religious belief for the conduct. What they're supposed to ask is this a religious exercise? And again, no one in any of these cases has disputed that it is. Is it a religious exercise? And if it is the government putting substantial pressure on somebody to forego that exercise? All of the courts that have gotten it wrong, actually, have simply failed to cite their binding circuit precedent for how to figure out if there's a substantial burden. And instead, they've sort of drifted off into this analysis and said, well, you know, you're really far enough away, your cooperation is remote enough that this isn't a substantial burden. But what's wrong about that is that the question of when you're far enough away is a question of religious belief and theological basis, and it's really for the religious people to decide. The Supreme Court decided a case called Thomas v. Review Board in the line of cases that Congress incorporates into RFRA. And in Thomas, the objection wasn't limited to simply the Jehovah's Witness saying, I can't go fight in the war. It was also, I can't make parts of tanks that somebody else may later make an independent choice to use to go fight in a war. The court simply said, it's not for us to judge Mr. Thomas's line. He drew a line. It's not for courts to look beyond it. The mistake those courts have made is they've looked beyond it. They've said, let me get inside your religious objection. What you're really upset about is these drugs, not the policy, and therefore you ought to feel okay. That's just not something courts are permitted to really do.
Bill, we've got another question from our audience. You want to take another call?
Sure.
All right, let's go to our next question.
Hey, my name is Andrew Brasher. I work for the Alabama Attorney General's Office, and I have to apologize because I'm one of the ones that just joined the call recently when I got the email reminder, so I apologize if this has already been addressed, but I was wondering if you could address the new regulations that the HH Secretary put out with regard to the nonprofits, and specifically how the how those regulations that create sort of a compromise position from the Obama administration, how they're supposed to work with self-insured plans.
Thanks, Andrew. This is Mark Rienzi. So the short answer is the proposal was really short on details about self-insured plans. So there actually is not a proposed rule in the, I forget how long, 60 or 80 page document the government issued in early February. There's not a proposed rule on self-insured plans at all. There is only a proposed rule on sort of traditional third-party plans. So what the document says is it throws out a few different possibilities. Maybe we can make your third-party administrator become, you know, sort of magically turn itself into an insurance company and write a policy. Many of those are just simply not insurance companies, so the notion of them writing insurance policies is somewhat bizarre. Maybe we'll get somebody else to provide it. But they don't really give an answer, and they don't have a proposed rule. So one of the big glaring problems with the February notice of proposed rulemaking is that there simply is no proposed rule for self-insureds. Doesn't mean that in July we're not going to see a final rule for self-insureds. They do talk about self-insurance, but they don't actually have a concrete proposal. And so one of the problems for people with self-insured plans is, you know, even in the comment period, they're sitting here looking, they don't quite know what they're asked to comment on because there isn't a firm proposal on the table. And ultimately, what I suspect will happen with the self-insureds is similar to what many of the people with third-party insurance plans are saying, is essentially, as long as the government is requiring that a necessary part of the policy I'm providing, a necessary automatic legal result of it, is complete access, free access to these drugs for people and their minor children, I'm not going to be satisfied with it. I mean, that's what I suspect you will see out of the people with self-insured plans if and when the government gets around to issuing a rule for self-insureds.
We do have another audience member question. We'll get to that momentarily. I just want to say people continue to join the call having received a late notice of a reminder. We apparently had a technical problem with our reminder notice. We want to apologize for that and let you know that we record these calls. This call is being recorded, and we will move this to the top of our priority list in order to get it posted online. So if you missed the opening remarks by Bill Saunders and Professor Mark Rienzi, please check our website. We'll post this as soon as possible. We've now got two questions pending in our audience, so let's go to our next caller.
Oh, this is Hadley Arkus, and I too saw the Dean's note rather late, so I caught only the end of Mark's presentation, but I've been listening to the exchanges, and those have been illuminating. I just want to just ask Mark and Bill if this question has come up. The Church's position, for example, the Catholic Church's position on contraception and abortion has been based on natural law reasoning, moral reasoning, a kind of a combination of embryology with the leaven of or the weave of moral reasoning. And so Bishop Laurie said, we're not simply seeking an exemption from the law. We think the law itself is wrong. It's not a Catholic position or a Protestant position. It's an American position. Now, in that case, you find employers objecting to the mandate, not on any distinctly religious grounds, but on moral grounds. This is the problem we had years ago with the Civil Rights Restoration Act, where there's a willingness to give an exemption based on religion, a very narrow ground. But the report was there were many hospitals refusing to perform abortions that did not have any religious provenance. So Mark and Bill, have you faced this? Do we have some cases here? We probably have some of employers who are not claiming a religious ground for their objection. Is that coming into play? And are we in a position in which we're defending the freedom of religious institutions to avoid the mandates, but not the freedom of those people claiming a distinctly moral objection, not invoking religious faith?
Hadley, this is Mark Rienzi. It's a great question. So, you know, first the litigation answer. The litigation answer is, to date, all of the litigations are by religious objectors.
That's what I thought. Yeah. And
from a personal point of view, I agree with you that the law ought to be such that somebody with a deeply held moral objection ought also to be protected. And ought also to not have to comply with this. If you look at the way we do conscience clauses in many other contexts, abortion is one. Many places, it doesn't actually have to be a religious objection to not participate in abortion. Capital punishment. We have statutes in a lot of states that have capital punishment and at the federal level that say even if you've taken a job in a corrections facility, even in a death penalty corrections facility, no one can force you to participate in capital punishment if you have a religious or moral objection to it. We do the same thing with assisted suicide. So there actually is and of course we do it with military conscientious objectors as well. So there is a broad precedent for having exemptions broad enough to cover deeply held ethical and philosophical refusal to participate in something you just can't participate in a free and pluralistic society. I think there's no question that is the correct approach. To date, though, no one has set forward to file the suit to try to make the argument. And the fact of the matter is it would be a harder argument for a non-religious conscientious objector because they can't necessarily rely on the same laws the religious folks can.
And because it also, Mark, forces us into the odd posture of denying that there's a moral ground for the laws. That is to say that, you know, we're justified in making laws only when we're in position of propositions that speak to what is in principle right or wrong, just or unjust for others as well as ourselves. So we back ourselves in a position to make this larger defense of disclaiming any moral ground for the laws we're making. So it's an awkward position all around. Well, thanks very much for your reflections on this, Mark.
My pleasure.
We have at least one caller question pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Martin Nussbaum in Colorado Springs. What prevents an insurer, either of a employer's direct insurer for its employees, or an insurer who is providing the stop-loss coverage for a self-funded plan, of looking at the mandate in light of the law that you're citing in the litigation, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act? I presume you're citing the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause as well, and saying I do not feel that I have to, if I have an employer who's conscientiously opposed for religious grounds, these other laws trump the contraceptive mandate, and I'm not going to, I will agree to enter a contract not to provide these benefits. What prevents someone from doing that, and what's the risk of an insurer for doing that?
This is Mark Rienzi. I think what prevents them is the fear of massive fines. And I think the risk is, I think the risk is real that the administration would look to punish an insurer who goes out and writes policies that don't comply with the Affordable Care Act because they judge that the mandate violates somebody's religious freedom. I would deeply appreciate and respect the insurer willing to be on the limb and say and do that. But the fact of the matter is the government, this goes back to the substantial burden point, the government has made the penalties for being wrong on this so massive that it would crush most businesses pretty quickly if the government shows up to collect them. So you would require an insurance company with, you know, enormous pockets and enormous spine to take that kind of a stand.
And does the Affordable Care Act fine system also apply to insurers or just employers?
I believe it also applies to the insurer. So I don't know this for certain, but my vague understanding is if Blue Cross writes the policy and they don't include the right stuff, I do believe Blue Cross can be on the hook. I'm not positive, but that's my working understanding. it's a really long law. I have to confess, I haven't read every page of it either.
Yeah.
Well, again, some folks joined the call late because of our tardy reminder and our technical difficulties. Let me repeat that if you have a question for Bill Saunders or Professor Mark Rienzi, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 10 minutes left in our call. Our phone lines are open. Bill, do you want to pose another question while we wait to see if there's a final question from our audience?
Well, I think Mark might draw it a little bit more, the point as I understand it, about the corporate form in the for-profit litigation. I think that there's two issues in that, or two questions. One is, does the corporation have religious freedom, First Amendment rights? But the other question is, even if that's unresolved, can the corporation assert the claims of the owners in a closely held corporation? And I believe that the Ninth Circuit has, hardly a super conservative circuit, has said that they can without resolving the question of whether the corporation itself has First Amendment rights. Do you have any comment on that, Mark?
Yeah, Bill, thanks. So there are really three different ways to have standing here. I actually think all of them work, but you only need one. One is that the corporation engages in a religious exercise, right? The corporation makes a decision for a religious purpose, namely, we think God doesn't want us to do X, therefore we won't do X. And that's the basis for the board of a corporation making a decision. I think it's pretty easy to say that's a religious exercise. They have standing. You don't need to think further about it. The second possible flavor is that the individuals who own and operate the corporation have standing. And this theory is simply, well, it's my corporation, and the government is trying to make me do something with it. And so it's just like any other piece of property. The government is trying to pressure me, and they've said, well, I'll destroy your property if you don't do what I tell you to do. And therefore, that is real pressure on the individual owners and shareholders of the corporation to do something. And the courts have actually also been quite clear that that is more than enough for Article III standing. There are questions about prudential standing, but as an Article III matter, the Supreme Court's decision of Franchise Tax Board makes clear that if you own the business and there's a big threat to the business, that's enough for Article III. And so the second flavor of standing would just be that the individuals who own the corporation have standing because, again, from a RFRA point of view, the question is, has the government exerted substantial pressure on these people to change their beliefs? And just to take a very simple example, if the government said to everybody on this phone call, if you go to such and such church this weekend, we will close the businesses that you own on Monday. Theoretically, that penalty is only being imposed against the corporation or the LLP or the law firm or whatever else it is that you own in the world. In reality, I don't think anyone could plausibly say that they have not pressured you, the individual, with the threat to crush your business. And so I think the individuals directly have their own standing because they are subject to government pressure. The whole point of holding corporations liable for anything, Richard Posner explains this in the context of corporate criminal liability, the whole point of holding a corporation liable for anything is to impose pressure on the shareholders to do things differently. That's the reason you ever hold a corporation liable. So when the government says we're going to fine Hobby Lobby $1 million a day, it is precisely because they know that will put pressure on the controlling shareholders to do something differently, to act differently. And so they do impose pressure, and therefore the fact that you own it as a corporation doesn't eliminate that pressure and shouldn't matter. As to the third part point, the associational standing point that Bill raised, Bill, as usual, is correct. The courts that have addressed the issue have said, well, of course the company has standing to assert the religious objections of the owners, the people who want to run the company a certain way. And the Ninth Circuit on a couple of different occasions has used that to say, we don't need to get into the details of can a corporate entity exercise religion or does the shareholder have a right, because it's indisputable that at the very least the company has the right to assert the owner's religious objections. That's sort of a classic third-party standing situation where the penalty imposed on one entity injures the rights of another. Here, the owners exercise religion through their companies. When the government says, okay, fine, I'll crush your company, it, of course, is imposing a burden on the individuals who own and operate it a certain way and whose conduct the government's trying to change. So one way or the other, they're standing, and from my point of view, in all three ways, they're standing.
Bill, our phone lines are open right now. If anyone has a final question, push star and then the pound button on your telephone. Otherwise, it looks like we do have a final question. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, gentlemen. This is Joe Fisher. I'm a lawyer and a state legislator. Our state has strong language in our state constitution protecting conscious rights and along with a state religious freedom act. Do you think the state laws protecting conscious rights and religious beliefs can offer any protection from the federal HHS mandate?
This is Mark Rienzi. I think it's tough. I think the only way the state, you know, generally speaking, obviously a state right can't trump the federal requirement. But I think those types of state laws do put states in an odd position to the extent that they are going to be participants in federal exchanges. If there's a limit on what the state government can do, it's not all that clear to me that a state government with laws like the ones you're describing can administer a federal exchange if that exchange is going to end up forcing people to do things that violate their religion. So I think it's sort of a distant protection. Certainly, to my knowledge, none of the existing cases have asserted state law claims. Generally speaking, I don't think you can assert a state law claim to say that the federal government is violating a right that you have as a matter of state law. And so I think the only way those provisions get into play in this particular context is if they end up being a restraint on the state that stops the state from somehow cooperating or doing what the Affordable Care Act tries to make it do.
Do you think it could be a possible challenge to a state-run exchange?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, it's been a very interesting discussion and presentations. Let me give each of you a chance to express any final thoughts or wrap up. And why don't we go in reverse order? Bill, if you have any final thoughts, you can take a minute now, and then we'll turn to Mark Rienzi for his final thoughts.
Not really, except that obviously these cases are going to continue to go forward. Even if the February 1st proposed regulation is adopted, it's not going to resolve the issue. Even if it somehow resolved the issue in the minds of religious institutions and organizations, which it doesn't. I mean, many of those plaintiffs will try to go back to court. It doesn't even address the for-profit question. So litigation on this is going forward, and I think it's got to work its way up towards the Supreme Court. There have already been a number of circuit decisions coming out different ways, although most of them, again, have been kind of on the side of the plaintiffs. Some of them haven't. So I think that we're headed for the Supreme Court going to have to resolve this by this time next year.
Professor Mark Rienzi, a final thought.
Let me just briefly pick up on Bill's point and talk about the future. I think Bill's right. I mean, the Supreme Court will have a crack at this sometime fairly soon, because right now a bunch of those preliminary injunction cases for the for-profits are all in the courts of appeal with a bunch of arguments, including an en banc argument in the Tenth Circuit set for May. Unless everybody suddenly gets in line and the dominoes fall so that there's really complete agreement among the circuits, it seems entirely likely that by late summer or early fall, there will be a split among the courts of appeal on these preliminary injunction rulings. And I assume somebody will present that to the Supreme Court and say, why don't you take a look at this now and spare everybody another 3 or 4 years of multiplied litigation coast to coast that we've been going through. If I were the Supreme Court, I think that's the right kind of case to grab at the preliminary injunction level, principally because it really is all about the law. So I think it's entirely possible, although entirely to the Supreme Court's discretion, that they could take something next year. If not, then things will go back down and go through the trial courts again, and then we'll come back up. But we're not avoiding the split here. The split is almost certain to stick.
Well, terrific. Let me thank both of you on behalf of the Federalist Society. I want to thank Bill Saunders and Mark Rienzi for joining us today. I also want to thank our audience, and again, apologize for the technical problem we had in getting our last-minute reminder around. This call will be posted as a podcast as soon as possible, so if you missed the opening remarks, you can check back in with us on our website and download the podcast. I also want to invite folks to join us for our teleform call tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Time, when we'll be discussing copyright enforcement. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.